I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. Paris has a lot of curved streets and alleys that open onto the great boulevards like the Champs-Élysées. Venice is waterways under bridges leading to the Grand Canal. Rome is a warren of narrow lanes on the way to spectacular piazzas. The charm of a city, in short, is more often than not the experience of its streets. The Ramblas in Barcelona, the Kudamm in Berlin, Via del Corso in Rome. So what makes a street magical? Is it diversity? Is it democracy? Is it history? The Boulevard Saint-Michel in Paris is lined with stores, with book tables and cafes. Princess Street in Edinburgh has buildings and stores on one side, looking across to a park and a castle on the hill beyond. Here's one way to think of the question of the greatness of streets. Would you rather have a great meal on a lousy street or a mezzo-mezzo meal on a really great street? Or would you rather own the prettiest house on a so-so street or an okay house on a really heavenly street? Streets are the connective arteries of cities and towns. They're what unite the individual with the community, the public with the private. Connection listeners, what are your favorite streets? Not 50, not just one either, three. Three favorite streets in the world. And if the Ramblas in Barcelona isn't on your list, well, that's something to explain. 1-800-423-8255 makes the streets connection, the great streets connection, or 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest, Robert Campbell, is the architecture critic for the Boston Globe and the inspiration for this program, and he's a street smart guy himself. Welcome back, Bob
nice
Campbell.
To see you, Chris.
What's your idea of a great street?
Well, I think the first thing you would say about a great street is that it is not devoted to any single purpose. We've had traffic engineers who think of them as sort of hydraulic engineering feats, the purpose of which is the flow of traffic, and then they become traffic sewers, and they become hopeless for any other purpose. A good street is a mixture of a place to walk, a place to enjoy the architecture and the trees and the rain and the weather and everything else. It's part of where we live.
That gets you started. Mixed use. That was always a Jane Jacobs rule, too. What about...
You can't go too far wrong with Jane Jacobs.
What is it that collects people in streets?
Well, I think you have to, if you look at cities, you know, you realize that the most important public spaces in cities are the streets, not the parks, the squares, the waterfronts. As important as they are, the streets are where we spend our lives. It's where we shop, where we meet our friends, where we express ourselves through the architecture of our houses and how we paint them and so on. And we have to remember that when we think about cities. We tend not to do that because of the kind of engineering aspect of streets.
All right, but get more particular in terms of size and shape, you know, height limits, distance from the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any rules here? How long can a street be and still be great? How wide does it have to be? How narrow does it have to be?
Mm-hmm. It can be as wide as the Champs-Élysées. It can be as narrow as an alley in Venice. If it has the right characteristics, if it has the right mix of uses and people and activity, then it's fine. I remember walking down a street in Korea once, that in a very poor part of Korea, and the buildings were all made of, you know, almost cardboard and crushed cans. But the scale, the sun, the activity, the busyness, people working and living and shopping in the street made it a great street, I thought. But then you take a place like Commonwealth Avenue in Boston, which was highly regulated. All the houses have to be back a certain distance from the street. But the ingenuity of that is with 60% of that facade, you can come forward with a bay window. So the bay-windowed streetscape of the Back Bay was legislated before the Back Bay was even filled. So there can be very appropriate rules to make great streets.
What does regulation and uniformity and rules have to do with it? The Back Bay is an interesting example because there were setback requirements and height requirements. It all had to do...
There were minimal height requirements, no maximums. Nobody invented the elevator.
Exactly. That's the whole point. You couldn't go beyond a certain height. And yet there's tremendous variety in those houses that are all the same, as I'm sure there was in the Korean
Well, I think you hit on a really important point, and one that's more appropriate to America than other countries. We insist on individualism in our architecture. And so what you want to hit in an American street is that perfect balance between the collective, the public, the communal, on the one hand, and the individual expression on the other. And referring again to Commonwealth Avenue, the mall, the trees meeting overhead, that's the public expression of ourselves as one community, as one group of people. And then behind those trees, everybody can go nuts, showing off how rich they are and what great taste they have in their architecture, and that's exactly what they did within certain constraints. You wouldn't want to have something too wild that would you never want to create architecture that is disrespectful of its surroundings.
Now, but you remind me of some of the streets of Florence, of Paris too, which are really defined by the walls, blank walls, enclosing little bits of private paradise that you you may or may not see on a walk down those streets. You know they're there.
A wonderful example of that is a city like Cordoba in southern Spain, where you walk down the street and it appears to be stucco walls on both sides.
Exactly.
But every now and then, and very frequently, there's an iron grate, a black iron grate. You look through, there's an incredible little private plaza with a fountain and an orange tree, and the oranges kind of glow through. So that's another way of putting public and private together that works very well, especially in that climate.
I want to get to this with callers, too. But what's your view, Bob Campbell, on the simple notion, is there any such thing as a good new street? Can you think of one in the world today?
Well, I've written that I can't. There are a lot of great streets from the past, and I've asked everybody I know, what's the great 20th century street? What's the Ramblas, the Champs-Élysées, the whatever you like? You know,
well, Fifth Avenue, surely.
Fifth Avenue. Well, Fifth Avenue is a 19th century street, too.
Well, take Public Library North. That was built 100 years ago. That's a pretty wonderful street, up through the park. I mean, that's...
I wouldn't call it one of the world's great streets, but it's a good street. But sure, I mean, I think in general we haven't done a good job in the 20th century making streets, and we architects are very much to blame for that. There was a major attack on streets from the architectural profession in the first half of this century. Streets were regarded as purely for traffic, and people should withdraw from them, turn their backs on them toward interior green spaces, and there were many examples of that, some good, some bad. In general, it destroys the quality of city life. In general, we should open ourselves with trust and social affection to the streets. That's where we come together. That's where we meet one another.
What are your three favorites?
Oh, wow. I also list the Ramblas in Barcelona. My pal Alan Jacobs, whose book you've got in front of you, who teaches at Berkeley, says that when he polls people, the Ramblas always comes out first as their favorite street in the world. But
it's so long since I've been there that I've really forgotten it. Remind us.
Well, it's one of the things that makes it so nice is that there's nothing distinguished about it aesthetically. What it has is two narrow traffic lanes on both sides, a long continuous island down the middle like Commonwealth Avenue, but it's paved in Barcelona, and it's endlessly active with sidewalk cafes that are served from across the streets from the walls of the shops and cafes on the inside. There are public performances there. There are trees there. There's every kind of mix of activity. And then, very importantly, you can step off it into very interesting places. The whole Gothic quarter of Barcelona is on both sides, the most interesting streetscape, the most interesting part of the city. That's very important, too. I had a friend once who had a cold water basement flat in Greenwich Village. It seemed like a horrible place to live. And he said, oh, you don't understand. It's the outgoings. I can walk to 100 restaurants, 50 theaters, hundreds of people. The outgoings are very important in where you live, not just the house that you live in.
Greenwich Village in Manhattan, the Ramblas in Barcelona. Name one more, and we'll go to calls.
On New Year's Eve, on my block, my one-block-long street in Cambridge, Antrim Street, we had a New Year's Eve party, and a lot of people showed up who hadn't lived on the block for years. I'm a great fan of my street, and I wrote an article about it once for Architectural Record magazine, and I called it Outlaw Street because it violates every single principle of zoning today. The houses are too close together, too close to the street. There's too much lot coverage. They're too dense. The trees are too close to the curb for snow clearance, on and on and on. But it's a wonderful street. What we tend to do is take the suburban street as a model and then retrofit the city as a suburb by writing all these rules about setbacks and green space. City streets don't have to be like that. They can be quite crowded and dense, and we love them for that. We go to Newbury Street because we love the congestion.
But don't knock Elm Street either. I mean, that suburban We think of it sort of as a Victorian.
I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying let's not make it the only model.
Well, that's fair enough, too. Say what you like about Elm Street.
The original Elm Streets in cities like the early suburbs like Newton, there were rules that nobody could put up fences, and there was a kind of the green lawn, the stretch of green lawn down the block in front of the houses became a kind of common park, and there was a wonderful sense of being both in a community, in a town, and at the same time in a kind of park, and I think that was wonderful.
You mentioned Antrim Street. I wanted to stick with it. You've written about it a lot. What is it that defines it socially? Does anybody ever move out of Antrim Street? Or is it the same 50?
There's one family that rented in two different locations on the one block street and finally bought a house. So people who can hang out there if they can.
What defines it socially?
It's changing very rapidly now. The generation before I came there 30-some years ago was mostly Irish, what you would call, by and large, blue-collar.
Townies?
Townies, okay. And then my generation of kind of young professionals, as we were called then, yuppies, kind of moved in and took over. And now we're being supplanted gradually by much wealthier, younger people who have SUVs and things like that that bother some of the older residents. So there's yet another generation coming through.
The Internet IPO crowd.
I guess. And I'm sure they will integrate into the street and be as much a part of the society there, too. It took us a while, and it's going to take them a while.
For folks who've never seen Inman Square, Cambridge, I mean, what does it look like?
It's just ordinary wood frame houses and three deckers set rather close together on a crowded street that's about a quarter of a mile long. And there are four houses in the backyards of what were houses originally. I mean, it was not in any sense a fancy neighborhood. But that sense of a slight crowding means that you meet your neighbors. You overhear their kids making too much noise or their dog is making trouble on your lawn or something like that. A million things like that that are minor frustrations, in fact, bring people together.
We're talking about the streets where we live, the streets we love, the streets we dream about, the streets of our imagination, too, the streets of the world. What makes a great street, Connection listeners, and what are your three favorite in the world? 1-800-423-8255.
Let's not talk only about individual streets. Let's talk about networks. I mentioned Alan Jacobs, and one thing he does is go around the world and take the center square mile of every city and count the number of street intersections. The city with the most street intersections is Venice, and I'm not counting the canals, just the streets.
Yeah, 1,500 street intersections.
Per square mile.
Parts of New York have like 17 or something.
Irvine, California ranks last, and the more intersections you have and the shorter blocks you have, and Jane Jacobs says,
that's another thing, Jacob's rule, right.
The more vitality you'll have in the city. In general, that's true, I think.
So what are her four rules? Mixed use, human density, short blocks, and old and new buildings.
Old and new buildings mixed, and different economic groups mixed. Very, very important. The rich people benefit from the poor people who may want to do babysitting or mow the lawn or shovel the walks. The poor people benefit from the rich people because they may have more clout at City Hall and demanding services. And best of all, democracy thrives when we learn about one another and can vote on the basis not only of our own issues, but the issues of our neighbors.
I put the question again to Connection listeners, and you don't have to answer it yet, Bob Gamble, but would you rather have a kind of ordinary house on an absolutely great street or an absolutely great house on an ordinary street? 1-800-423-8255, the Streets Connection. Rebecca is calling from Buffalo, New York.
My hometown.
Hello.
Hey, Rebecca, welcome.
Thank you very much. I wanted to comment on a wonderful street that I saw last year in Kiev, the capital of the Ukraine. And the street's name is Krasnoyarsk Boulevard. It's about twice as wide as the Champs-Élysées, and it was built that way because they wanted to be able to land planes on it in the event that there was a war. Yes. They close the street down every weekend so that the masses just take over the street, and it's filled with people. There's no traffic at all, and it's a wonderful street of the world.
Sounds great. I wish I'd seen it.
You must go visit soon because there's very little American influence so far, but you can see it creeping in year by year.
Uh-huh.
What sustains a street life on a boulevard that's twice as wide as the Champs-Élysées? That's hard to imagine.
It is hard to imagine, and hard even more to imagine that it would be filled with people all weekend long, but Because a lot of the people in the Ukraine, and particularly in Kiev, are not what you would consider middle class or wealthy. This is their life, and they go and they walk the streets and say hello to people and look at the fine things in the stores.
Rebecca, thank you.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
And the same to you. 1-800-423-8255. The streets connection. Randy is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Randy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm quite intrigued by the conversation, and I've been fortunate enough to see many of the streets that Mr. Campbell has spoken of, including the Rambus just last summer. But I want to talk about a street that actually is very different than those grand avenues, and that's Moody Street in Waltham, Massachusetts.
Okay.
And I think that I have a studio very close by to Moody Street, and I've gotten to know it over the years, and it is full with all the elements that you mention. And it's a rather working-class neighborhood, and it has all the vitality and its own kind of grandeur, though it doesn't really have the grandeur of Comm Ave. And I think it's important to include a street like this in your listing of wonderful streets to go to.
Randy, what does it look like, and when was it built?
Moody Street must go back to, the early 1900s. And it... it's got a combination of a whole variety of ethnic restaurants and stores that are owned by, just a real diversity of immigrants. And it has the requisite intersections coming off of it with triple-decker, double-decker, single homes. And it culminates in a really lovely common at the end of Moody Street, Moody and Main.
I'd like to use Moody to make a point. Moody Street was an industrial street with mills and so on the Charles River.
That's
initially.
Correct.
And then it went into a complete tailspin. Everything was boarded up, and there was only very low-grade retail along it. And people get unnecessarily depressed in situations like that. In fact, when the value goes down, it becomes easier for people to invest. And neighborhoods like that become restaurant neighborhoods, and they come back. And there is no great older neighborhood in the world today that was not, by today's standards, a slum at some point in the past. And I remember when Mayor Wagner in New York in about 1960 identified West 84th Street between Amsterdam and Columbus as the worst block in the city.
Mm-hmm.
All boarded up, druggies. You can't afford a condo there today. The Marais District in Paris, now the most fashionable district in town, came very near being demolished in the early 1960s as a hopeless slum. Moody Street's a perfect example of that kind of comeback.
It is, but by the same token, the indigenous, if you will, citizens and workers here are, potentially going to be threatened by that gentrification. 60 artists are occupying the mill buildings, and they've given the neighborhood sort of a cachet now.
That's a very serious problem, and it happens all the time. Artists move in and renovate a neighborhood, and then somebody else takes it over. There are ways of slowing that down, but it's a very important issue.
Randy, thank you. Dead on. Moody Street in Waltham, Massachusetts. 1-800-423-8255 makes the streets connection. Jim is calling from a car phone.
Hi, Chris. Good morning.
And welcome, Jim.
I guess as far as that street that I like, I guess a couple of those, and then I had a quick comment. I think looking at it on a smaller scale, I would think along the lines, not so much as a particular street, but more of an urban landscape of Siena, Italy, I think is just, I was there years ago, and it just struck me as being just such a fantastic kind of maze and kind of just a tapestry of spaces. And I think that's really the thing that makes an urban area so, compelling is really the spatial component of being able to move from point to point and all the landmarks.
And in Siena, the way you explode out of those narrow streets into the great Piazza del Campo is just unbelievable.
That's about as close to heaven as I've seen Siena, no question.
Yep. And then if you look at it on a larger scale, I think kind of more of a 20th century type of streetscape, you think more along the lines of like Ginza in Tokyo, which is just kind of just, really over the top, kind of just wild, kind of just mob scene comes sometimes, but it's really exciting at the same time.
Neon lights all over the place.
Oh, it's amazing.
Jean-Paul Sartre said when they took him to, I think it was here in Las Vegas, he said, if only I could not read, I would think I was in paradise.
But I guess my comment was that I think, one of the things I think that is touching on what Bruce was talking about earlier in terms of, you know, has there really been a, you know, a great 21st century street? Are we really doing something, you know, what have we done lately that's really, you know, compelling? And I really wonder if, you know, looking at it just from an architectural standpoint, you know, are architects really the ones that we should, you know, really turn to design, you know, an urban streetscape? You know, if you look at it historically, you know, I could say there's probably not a good track record of being successful in trying to plan these things or trying to design this, these feelings that you get when you go to Siena or other places that people like. You know, there's more to it, and I think it's sometimes, I'd be curious to see how Bruce feels of, you know, how could we do this differently? Why has American architecture particularly not been very successful in being able to understand and recreate the character of some of the more compelling urban spaces?
Jim, it's a great question. Bob Campbell.
We talked about mixed use, and mixed use means a mixed number of people involved in designing the street. And what we've had in the 20th century is the century of experts, traffic engineers and developers and bankers and different people with different expertises, you know, having their say. The only way it's going to work is when we all mix it up. And the street gets designed by everybody and is a multiple initiative. That's what happened more in the past. There was more regulation in Siena and in those middle-aged cities than you probably think there was. But nevertheless, I think we don't want to hand it over to any one set of experts, architects, or anyone else.
Jim, thank you. 1-800-423-8255 makes the streets connection. 1-800-423-TALK. Melissa is calling from Memphis, Tennessee.
Yes.
Welcome, Melissa.
Thank you. I was just calling to say something about streets that don't have any of what you're talking about. And that is, I grew up in South Carolina on a dirt road that had two houses before you got to my house about a mile down. And one of them was my grandmother's house. And when I was 10 or so, my little brother and I would walk to my grandmother's house on this dirt road, you know, completely safe, pick flowers, throw rocks. If you were driving, you had to drive so slow that if you saw somebody and you didn't know them, you'd wave. And if you did know them, you'd stop and talk.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very valuable to me. But there were no stores, no restaurants, very few neighbors. And but there was a
nobody
lot.
Spoke Italian either, probably.
No. Everybody spoke South Carolina redneck, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was I guess it's not even considered a street.
I wouldn't call it a street, but I would say there's a lesson in that, too, and that is the more you slow the traffic down, the more socially pleasant the street is going to be.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of what's called traffic calming going on in cities now. We're no longer thinking of streets as trying to bomb people through town at 30 or 40 miles an hour, but rather slow them down so the traffic on leather has a chance to be there, too.
Yeah. And it was, you could walk on the road and you were fine, or you know, if it snowed, people would go out and play in the middle of the dirt road, and, you know, yeah.
Listen, I like that rule. If you don't know them, wave. If you do know them, stop and talk.
Yeah, exactly. We that's what we did.
Melissa, thank you. 1-800-423-8255, the streets connection, or the dirt road connection, as the case may be. Julia is on the line.
Hello.
Welcome, Julia.
Hi. I want to bring us back to... You were talking earlier about people in cars and people on foot. I want to bring us back to sidewalks, to Madrid. Have you seen the sidewalks in Madrid? I lived there for about a year, and I noticed right off that there are designs on the sidewalks. They're very pretty, and they're also about twice the size, or maybe a little less than that, but they're very wide, and people walk there. They stroll after dinner, in the early evening, and then after their late dinner, you see couples and people socialize on the sidewalks. So that was the Madrid. That was really my comment.
Madrid is Judy, it's a very modern city. What are the old? Is this an old quarter of the city you're talking about?
It's not far from the downtown center. The downtown center, you don't see what I'm talking about. But if you go right outside of that, you see the wide sidewalks.
Of course, the evening stroll, the paseo, is deeply rooted in Spanish tradition. Madrid has wonderful street lights, so does Barcelona, so do other Spanish cities. I think the width of the sidewalk is important, and that there's some activity on the sidewalk. You often find kiosks and things like that in European cities. I don't think the patterning of the sidewalk, the example I always use is Paris. I ask you, what are the sidewalks made of in Paris? Do you remember?
No.
Asphalt. That's not what matters. What matters is the vertical surface and what happens on that, the shop fronts, the stores. I worked for years for an architect named José Luis Sert, who was a Spanish architect, and he talked about Paris, which he loved, as being a parade of elephants and parrots. And the elephants are the long rows of grayish-white, you know, 6, 8, 10-story buildings that most of Paris is made of. But the parrots are at ground level, and they are the bright little canopies and the people in their bright clothes and the food and everything else. And a parade of elephants and parrots is a very nice way of describing a good street, too, I think.
It's beautiful.
I just want to mention one thing. I just think that it's important. You mentioned earlier about cars and people, and I think that's an important dichotomy. That's, you know, the importance of cars versus people.
Mm-hmm. They have to be kept in balance. I don't believe in stripping cars out of streets. I think pedestrian streets don't work well in this country because we don't have the densities to pour people into them. I think the best American street has traffic in both directions and parallel parking on both sides.
That's interesting. It's an interesting question. What are the streets or the sidewalks made of? In Berlin, they're very distinctively made of a kind of cracked stone. I'm not quite sure how they set them all, but it's a very distinctive look. We'll come back to this after the break. I want to know what it tells you or not that the sidewalks in Paris are made out of asphalt. Does it tell you mainly that it doesn't matter what they're made of? Well, hold the thought, and we'll take it up when we come back. We're talking about streets on The Connection. 1-800-423-8255. We'll be back. We're funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by CSC Consulting, helping clients achieve business results through innovative consulting and systems integration solutions. And by Fair Market, providing e-commerce leaders with the power of online auctions and now hiring across all functions at www.fairmarket.com.
There lie the trees in the heart of town, and you'll hear a lark in any other part of town. Does enchantment pour out of every door? No, it's just on the street where you live.
I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Streets Connection. We're talking about the streets where enchantment pours out of every door with the architect and writer Robert Campbell. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. The question is, first, what are your three favorite streets in the universe? And second, as I said, would you rather own the most ordinary street, ordinary house on an absolutely great street, or an absolutely brilliant house on a no-account street? 1-800-423-8255 makes the streets connection. Jack Nasser joins us from Ohio. He's professor of urban planning at Ohio State University. Jack, I associate you with the notion that you can nail it down what makes a great street.
Well, we've done research with people to find out what folks like and dislike in terms of their neighborhoods and streets. So I could talk a little bit about that. This is a great show, by the way. I've enjoyed what I've heard.
Well, thanks, Jack.
From what we've been doing,
we bake it fresh every day.
from a local practice standpoint, when I have my students work with neighborhoods and planning, we continually run into the issue that major traffic streets disrupt the neighborhood, and we have to go to the city and say, you know, you might want to try some traffic calming to slow down. So it's good to hear these things coming out. Anyhow, the work that we did for the book called The Evaluative Image of the City initially interviewed hundreds of people in two southern cities, Knoxville and Chattanooga, and basically asked them to describe what they liked and disliked visually in their cities. For each person, we could create a map of their preferences and the reasons for them. We built up a large evaluative map of the city that identified five kind of features of preference and dislike, and have subsequently done a lot of controlled studies and could pretty well confirm that these seem to be things that folks want to see in their neighborhoods and streets.
Five rules. Let's hear them.
Yeah. And I'll give you some other. The first one is naturalness, vegetation, views to vegetation. We've just completed a study looking at that particular feature. Naturalness, there's now research showing it as a restorative element for people's lives. And we did a study where we basically pre-stressed people, had them drive on simulated roads, one which was had a lot of vegetation, one had a little less, and one had virtually none. And then afterwards did test to get at their anger levels and frustration levels. And what we found was as you increase the amount of vegetation on the street, their anger dropped and their frustration level dropped.
I buy that as a general rule, but at the same time, there's almost no vegetation in San Francisco or Venice, so you always have to realize that there are many different ways of doing things.
Oh, sure.
Okay.
I'm just talking about generally, there is now strong evidence that nature is restorative. And sure, there's cities, Siena also, a great place that doesn't have much mm-hmm. vegetation. And,
but as a rule, I'd buy it.
Okay, take us through the five, guys.
Yeah. Upkeep. You know, standard thing, well-kept places are seen as desirable, dirty, dilapidated places are undesirable. And upkeep turns out to have research shows it has a relationship to both fear of crime and actual rates of crime. So improving the upkeep of an area, not only is something that people will like better, but it has this other effect on one of the major problems in urban areas, and as crime and fear of crime. Openness. People tend to prefer what is sort of bounded open spaces. That there is a boundary, but there's an open view to it with clear views as opposed to crowded and congested places. Now, of course, there are other places that are heavily used people places that folks also like. Historical significance. This one's kind of interesting in that it picks up two aspects. One is real history, which was mentioned earlier in the discussion, the mix of older and new buildings, but also people other than architects will look at things that are imitation history and think that they look historical, and well, as a result, we like it. On my campus, mm-hmm. Surveys of the two favorite buildings of alumni. One is the oldest building on campus. Another one was one that the university tore down. The alumni were outraged that they tore it down, forced the university to rebuild a building very similar to what was originally there, without as much detail, etc. People look at it, and though it was built in 1969-70, think of it as a historic building, and they rate it as their second favorite building on campus. So historical significance, and then a mix of order and variety. And we've done work with particularly with commercial signscapes where we actually manipulated the degree to which there was complexity or variety and coherence. They hung together, and we asked passersby, merchants. We asked merchants which street they would most like their street to resemble, and we asked potential shoppers for their preference, excitement, and which one they would shop at. And everyone converged on this one visual form, which mixed complexity and variety. And there's sort of solid research on that in terms of both.
These are the in-depth views of East Tennessee.
Well, no, the original work was in Tennessee. Then there's been loads of follow-up studies, as I said, of different kinds, controlled research all over the country.
You're the one to ask, Jack, I think, what is the best new street that you know?
Best new? Actually, I'm not the one to ask. I'm not sure I could identify the best new street.
Well, with the five-part formula, it ought to be on somebody's drawing board right now.
That has those features.
I like that rule about a mix of order and disorder. I think that's very important.
Yeah.
We need to feel we're in a coherent universe. We need to feel also that we're in a universe where people can make their own gestures.
Yeah. Your comment earlier also about the controls, and someone in Switzerland in a number of the cities, an urban designer there was telling me that one of the historic cities there had five rules that dated back to like the 1300s. And those rules have been in sort of place, and then it's each individual person puts their building in place according to those rules, and it ends up with a very rich urban streetscape.
Uh-huh.
And so, as you were talking about, Siena probably has more rules than people think about. I think that's probably true.
You made a point about people wanting to feel enclosed and have views out, and that reminds me of two streets we have here in Boston, Charles Street and Washington Street, mm-hmm. both of which are slow S-curves. And so as you look down the street, it closes off by the curve, and you feel you are in a contained space. But as you move forward, it opens out and entices you on. I think that works very well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jack Nasser, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you enormously. 1-800-423-8255. Jack Nasser is professor of urban planning at Ohio State University. 1-800-423-8255 makes the streets connection. Anne is on the line.
Hi, how are you?
Welcome, Anne. Good.
My favorite street, I can't remember the name of it, but it's in Carlingford, which is in Ireland on the east coast, just shy of the border with Northern Ireland. And it's wonderful. There's a huge, deep, cold blue bay on one side of the road, and on the other side of the road there are these rolling hills with sheep, and then as you come around a corner you come right into Carlingford proper. And what they've done, which is something I think we can't leave well enough alone in America, they've had these huge ruined medieval castles that guarded the entrance to that bay. And instead of putting up ropes and historic monuments and a turnstile and collecting an admission, they've just let the town grow up around it to the point where the main pub on the main little street there is actually built into the back of a tumbling medieval castle.
I think that's so wonderful. You see that in Rome. You see that in other places. So.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering if perhaps in America we don't allow things to have the time they need to develop, and the fact that because we're such a new society relatively, we also have a tendency to go with whatever the fashion of the time is and wanting to tear things down and rebuild them in the new fashion as opposed to letting things organically develop over a long span of time. And just on a sort of a humorous note, the town I grew up in, Scituate, Massachusetts, beautiful town, a place where if you did well as an Irish American in the city of Boston, that was where you had your summer home. It became known as the Irish Riviera. And the rules that grew up societally there were very interesting because they were everything they were trying to get away from in the urban setting. For instance, my mother, who grew up in Dorchester, would never let us sit on the front steps of the house because in her estimation, that was what she used to refer to as playing South Boston.
Low class, absolutely.
And I thought it was very interesting because a lot of what's been discussed today about what makes a really good street has the people on the street.
Absolutely.
And how that in some way became a taboo, at least in some elements of society, whereas it's something that I think really adds to the life of the street.
Well, there's a technology side to that, too. Before a lot of things were invented, in the summertime you went out on the porch because that was the only place it was cool. You went and you played bingo in the church basement or something because there was no movies to go to, and a lot of television, let's say. And then about 1950, which is when American cities began to decline, a lot of inventions came in the car, so we went to the supermarket, the television, so we stayed home, the air conditioning, so we didn't need the porch in the street. And I think there's a devil's bargain there. We trade away some very important values in return for some very unimportant conveniences.
And thank you. I'm going to remember that picture of sheep and Bayswater Blue and the ruins in Carlingford. Thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Marie is on the line.
Hi, this is Maria.
Welcome, Maria.
Thank you. I'm really enjoying the show, as I always do.
Pleasure.
And I think that one of the most important qualities of a street is that it be hospitable and democratic. Mm-hmm. I heard you use that word democratic before.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, what that means is that it's accessible. I'm a person with a disability, and though I'm not in a wheelchair, I think curb cuts are really important. And I think well-painted crosswalks are very important. And I think street signs that are actually on streets, so you can see them and they're pointing in the right direction, all those things are very, very important. And not just because people have a right to them, but because they make everybody feel welcome.
Exactly.
And I think that that's really important. And, you know, I live in Cambridge. I just moved here in September, and I've spent a lot of time here. And I have to say that these streets are very, very hospitable. They're fabulous.
Can you make a street hospitable, Maria? I mean, Maria, how do you do it?
Well, I mean, I think by the ways that I just described, by making sure that people can see where they're going, that they're well maintained. Your second guest talked about the importance of the maintenance of a street. I think that that makes it very hospitable. I also think that, you know, there's another way of neighborhoods being hospitable, people being welcoming by keeping the outside of their house beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
All those things are very, very important, and they've certainly had an effect on me since I've moved to Cambridge.
One of the things you find in Cambridge is a great mix of different age groups and different economic and ethnic groups, and that's very helpful. And secondly, according to one study anyway, Cambridge and Somerville are the two most densely populated cities in the entire United States outside of the New York metro area. They don't feel crowded, but that density creates the kind of life that you're talking about, I think, and that welcoming feeling.
Maria, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about streets, the streets where you live, where you want to live, where you want to spend an afternoon. 1-800-423-TALK. Bruce is on the line. Hello, Bruce.
Oh, hello.
Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. I wanted to nominate it's not really a street as you're talking about it, but there's an approach road. There's a monastery called El Escorial in Spain, and there's an approach road from that up to a Spanish Civil War monument called Valley of the Fallen, Valle de los Caídos. Excuse me. And it's main, you know, most of the traffic is motor traffic, but there's a lot of people that would do pilgrimages on that and go from the monastery several miles up to this valley, and the final curve of the road, you would come around and you'd see this monument, which was a 250-foot cross that had been built by the losing side in the Spanish Civil War, the Republicans. To honor the Franco's friends who had died, and it was quite
built by the losers in honor of the dead of the mm-hmm. of the winners.
Yeah, and it was quite a strange dichotomy, because you're going through this beautiful country. And then you get to this thing, and that's really nice. And then you find out, well, yeah, the bad guys are, you know, the winners made the losers do it. It was kind of sad in a way.
Bruce, we haven't talked about that whole issue of procession, of the kind of walk, almost a parade you take through a city. A great example is in Prague. If you start at Wenceslas Square and you go gradually downhill to the river and you cross the river on the Königsbrücke or the Karlsbrücke, and then you come to a kind of rising switchback street, and all the time the castle, Kafka's castle, is up on the hill to your right, and eventually you end up in the courtyard of that. Processions like that are very important and can only really occur in fairly well-built-up cities.
Bruce, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Gary is calling from Oxford, Mississippi. Hello, Gary. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I wanted to know more about the trend of a dilapidated street becoming hip as a result of artists moving in, specifically how an artist's neighborhood can stay that way and not become gentrified.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, the artists are traditionally the sort of the first settlers of abandoned old city neighborhoods.
Soho is the classic example, but there are many.
And then come the restaurants, and then come the
and then the prices
law offices,
go out of sight,
right.
And the artists get driven away. We live in a constitutional democracy, and I have a right to buy, and someone else has a right to buy, and so it's difficult under the American Constitution to establish legally the kind of rules and regulations that would keep one group there. There are, I think, ways that cities have of kind of slowing these things down through zoning and all, but I think it's a kind of an inevitable change, and you can only hope to keep it from being too disruptive. It is very disruptive. It's happening now in Fort Point Channel in Boston. It's happening in other areas.
Mortgage yourself up to your neck, Gary. Buy everything you can while you can and keep it. 1-800-423-8255, the streets connection. Alan is calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
Yeah, a couple of the things that I haven't heard mentioned that make a street interesting are the element of ambiguity of the nature of the space and surprise. The street that I think of, I don't remember the name exactly, but it's a street in Old Fez, Morocco, that leads from the Boujaloud Gate. It curves around so that you're always turning, and you might turn one turn you might open, the street might open wider into a kind of a broad boulevard, and the next moment you turn, you don't even know if you're still on the same street, and it could be, you could turn into a small alley, which could be the entryway to someone's house. And it's a very surreal feel to it. And that element of surprise, to me, is what makes a street interesting. And it's there's a tremendous mix of activities. It's a working street, but it also has has tourists. It has people walking by with donkeys and donkey carts and pedestrians all mixed together.
The unpredictability is what keeps it interesting. Mm-hmm. We tend to design neighborhoods that are entirely predictable because we feel secure in them.
Yeah.
Alan, thank you. I've not been to Morocco. We'll go one day. Thank you. 1-800-423-8255, the streets connection. John is on the line.
Hi. My most memorable street I lived on for 7 years is Delancey Place in Philadelphia. I lived there while I was a student at Drexel University. It's a narrow street that runs, snakes its way through the center of Philadelphia from west to east, and ends up on the waterfront in what's known as the Society Hill section.
Not to be confused with Delancey Street in New York.
That's right. This is Delancey Place, and it consists mostly of four-story brownstones, apartments, and some businesses, and it's immaculately kept. The homes are either private or their apartments are other than a place that had been owned by the Girard family of Philadelphia and the famous banking family, and it had been converted to apartments. And it was just such a memorable place living there. They had a two-man elevator, which my friends like to take, which frequently got stuck between floors. But and then on this particular building I lived at, I lived in on the fourth floor were the servants' quarters, and which were inaccessible. And until one time, I was able to get a ladder and go up there, and it was like going through a time machine. There were no electrical appliances, gas lamp fixtures, old wallpaper. It was eerie, but that's how these homes, how old they were. And anyway, it
gives you a sense of your own identity to be able to place yourself in time that way. I think cities do that for you. You know, it's an interesting paradox. A city has to promise you nothing will ever change, and all the places where you had your first date and grew up will always be there to support you. And at the same time, it has to promise you a better future. And it's that paradox of memory and invention and how you balance those two that's critical, I think, to cities. I think you've described it very well.
John, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Richard is on the line.
Yes.
Hello, Richard.
Yes, calling from Cambridge. I'm a professor of architecture and urban design at Harvard. And I wanted to say that while all these are great streets, I also appreciate some of the driving streets, let's say like Santa Monica Boulevard or Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles.
Let's hear it for Wilshire Boulevard, yeah.
Yes. Because one of the great things about that street is that it actually drives on it at different speeds, and it has a great engagement with the landscape and with these various, you know, even though we're not talking about a long period of history, even different points in the development of that city, which is, an automobile-generated city, but does have moments of pedestrian intensity, you know, in the shopping.
Mm-hmm. Richard, let me ask you, what's the best new street in the world these days? Is there a 90s...
In a newly created city, or...
Well, I mean, the question is whether we've lost, as Bob Campbell worries, whether we've lost our talent for building these things.
Well, it's hard to say that there's a kind of newly constructed area that would be a great street. I think there are streets in some industrial districts that formerly were not occupied by a lot of people or a lot of retail or other kinds of activities that have been almost wholly transformed by the new way they're programmed or new interventions. Even the recent hullabaloo about Bill Bell is a lot about that.
Let me ask you and Robert Campbell, in the moments we have left, wouldn't you really rather have the most ordinary street, the most ordinary house on the greatest street, and vice versa?
I think I would, yes.
Bob Campbell?
I have an ordinary house on a great street, and that's where I want to be.
Well, you're a lucky guy. So do I. This has been fun, and thanks especially to the callers who make this kind of show happen. Thank you, Robert Campbell.
Thank you,
Jack
Chris.
Nasser, and to Alan Jacobs, who wrote the book Great Streets. We had help from Glenn Alexander, George E.Q. Hicks, Sheila Halsor, John Hoda, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
Bitches, Rockefeller, Noza, gold dust at my feet, on St. Silent Street.
Funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by Goldsmiths 3, creators of contemporary handcrafted jewelry and precious metals and rare gems. For the complete picture, goldsmiths3.com. And by Hutchins, Wheeler, and Dittmar, counselors of all, more than 150 years of dedication and service to its clients.
PRI, Public Radio International.